I can talk about my experiences. I don't know that I've got, like, you know, packaged wisdoms ready for anybody. And maybe that's a function of being a natural campaigner. You know, you're always looking for the next gap and the next strategy and approach to working on it.
Welcome to Season 3 of Her Story. This series delves into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. I'm Beck Bowman, and I'll be with you each week as we get to know these remarkable women whose lives have had a profound impact on communities throughout this state they choose to call home. Together, we will meet women who are cultural and environmental custodians, women in STEM and in business, women who care for the health and well-being of those around them, women who are changing the world from right here in WA. Jess Beckling lived her early 20s in an eco-warrior bush camp in southwest WA, like the protagonist in a young adult novel. Her passion for our natural environment, combined with humility and a natural leadership style, has seen her awarded the Bob Brown Foundation Environmentalist of the Year Award in 2021. She is currently the convener of the WA Forestry Alliance and was inducted into the WA Women's Hall of Fame in 2023. This is Season 3, Episode 9 of Her Story with Jess Beckling. This is Her Story. Jess Beckling, welcome to Her Story. You are here as part of the massive role you've played in the protection of WA's environment. When you were nominated for the WA Women's Hall of Fame, did you expect that? Did you know that you were going to be nominated?
No, I was completely surprised. I'd heard from a friend who had nominated me, Maureen, that I'd been nominated for a public big award, but I had no idea what it was.
The name, you're just like, oh, I get to be in a Hall of Fame. There's glamour associated with that, right?
Yeah, and you think, where's the hall and what is this? Is it like a star on the road? What on earth is happening now?
Is it like the town hall?
Is there a special hall?
Are there velvet curtains that come across the windows? Do you live in Denmark now? So you would be familiar with a small town country hall.
Yeah. The small town country halls are kind of central to the operating of small towns. But it wasn't a hall like that. We were inducted at the governor's house on St. George's Terrace. So there were velvet curtains, beautiful, beautiful velvet purple curtains. Yeah, an amazing experience, you know. You feel so honoured. And also it's weird to be pulled out from a group of people who you've worked alongside. I just figured it's a kind of feminist solidarity move to just be grateful for that and shine brightly.
So this is one of my personal bugbears, I guess. When you listen to women giving interviews and they're talking about awards they've given, there seems to be almost this rule that you have to mention the fact that, oh, no, it wasn't just me, it was everyone. And I was just a very small person and, you know, don't look at me kind of thing. When actually, no, like you've put a lot on the line for the work that you've done.
Yeah, it's complicated, isn't it? Because it's cultural. Mm. We know that it's important to acknowledge everybody else for all sorts of reasons, natural reasons that are coming straight out of your body, but also because maybe it's universal, but I think we've got a particular brand of it in Australia that, you know, if you stand up too tall, you'll be criticised. But I think as you move more and more into leadership roles, whatever that is, so many different kinds, so much different work, you are going to be criticised, you're going to be noticed, and you have to find some peace with that. Mm-hmm. And also, I've done some amazing leadership courses lately, including the Women's Environmental Leadership Australia course. And one of the very first things that they talk about is imposter syndrome. Mm. And you notice that every woman in the room with you, these incredible women who you admire so much, are struggling or have struggled to different extents. They're probably still struggling a little bit now with imposter syndrome. And I just thought, man, I don't want to be passing that on to other women. I don't want to be perpetuating that. It's a solidarity move, like I said. You know, you just have to make a decision in your perspective that you're not going to carry that because it's not helping you. It's not helping your movement.
You talk about the culture in Australia, and I guess there is still that tall poppy thing that happens, but you were actually born in and grew up in South Africa. Can you tell us a little bit about growing up in South Africa, what that was like?
Mm. Oh, look, I suppose it's just like growing up anywhere, very diverse experiences. As a white South African, a particular experience during apartheid, before it changed, before Mandela was released. And it was sad, you know, it was a sad place to grow up. There was a huge amount of disadvantage that was very, very present every single day in your face and in your mind. And I was one of those kids who was very conscious about justice. And I really struggled with, you know, having friends who I could play with in the backyard at home, but who couldn't come to school. And as I started to understand that that was impacting them as I got a bit older, and that there was simply nothing that I could see that was being done about it, or any pathway to make any changes. In my own small childlike way, I found that really sad and really disempowering. And I think I've carried that with me all my life, of looking for ways to be able to better articulate those issues and to find people who understand what I'm experiencing, who I can stand alongside.
Do you see now the intersection between the environmental protection work that you do and social justice?
Well, there's no separating them, I don't think. Whether it's Australia, South Africa, anywhere else around the world, the impacts of invasion, colonisation, extractivism, they've had multiple impacts, impacts on people, impacts on the environment, impacts on future generations, impacts on particular wildlife species, rivers, beautiful landscapes, incredible cultures, people's languages, people's medicines. It's all the same.
Can you unravel some of those layers for people?
Well, I suppose if, you know, we think about a few thousand years ago, you don't want to be sentimental, because it's not as if there's ever been a time in history where everything's been rosy and lovely, right? But if you think about a few thousand years ago where people were connected to country and they had been connected to that country for many, 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 many generations, and you have that deep knowledge of land, of your ancestors, of your stories, of your medicine, of your traditions, and you feel a kind of comfort, even given what must have been going on in different people's generations, that that's going to continue and you're going to be able to pass on those traditions, and that the environment's going to be more or less the same as it is now, and that you can trust that. And I think the particular intensity that we all experience now in our generation and previous generations, but not so far back, is that we've lost that connection and we're seeking it. Many, many of us are really intentionally, deeply seeking that reconnection, because we know that's what gives us our health and our well-being and our strength and capacity. But that loss of connection has resulted in so many different complicated impacts on ourselves and on our environment. And I think our work now, as environmentalists, social justice advocates, is to find those connections between those intersecting issues and look for solutions that actually bring along all of those issues. But instead, what we're seeing is this compartmentalized silo approach. If you think about climate change, for example, the conversation about climate change should be about, wow, we've messed this up, right? Like the last 200 years or more, industrialization, colonization, the impacts have been so profound. Where did we go so wrong? And we need to be looking at consumerism. We need to be looking at the way that multinationals are making massive profits by building in obsolescence so that we're throwing everything away. We need to be looking at all those things and coming up with solutions that address them. But instead, what we're doing is just saying, let's just have new technology. Let's decarbonize and have new technology. Great, let's decarbonize, but we also need to look at the biodiversity crisis. We also need to look at the social justice crisis. And we are capable of doing that. I really believe in our potential, our intelligence, our capacity to synthesize. But at the moment, the people who are in positions of power are not displaying that intelligence.
So from a very young age, you've had this strong sense of right and wrong and the importance of equality in society. What was the moment that you went, oh, hang on, like this is actually how I'm going to spend my life?
Oh, I know it. I'm really lucky that I actually know that moment. So I was 18 and I was at UWA. I was studying politics and economics. I'd had a year off between finishing school and going to uni and hung out in Melbourne and mucked around. Came back, didn't really know what I was doing, went to UWA like the rest of my family. I knew I wanted to do something in politics, green politics, and I thought economics would be a useful thread to that bow, but I hated it, absolutely. And joined the environment department I was just very lucky that that year was the development of some pretty extraordinary things happening in the forest campaign. I didn't realise that at the time. And I went on a bus with the other Environment Department students to a place called Giblet, which is just outside of Pemberton, incredible old growth carry forest, just blows your mind. Met some incredible people and put my name down to say, you know, please do contact me when the next stage of whatever this is happens. And so I was contacted and I went along to a meeting when the Conservation Council used to still be on Stirling Street in Perth. Still wasn't quite, you know, 100% there, but I knew that this was something that I wanted to keep exploring. And then there was the beginning of the logging started. And so there was a bus put together. I think there must have been about 45 of us driven down there, all volunteers. Most of us brand new to the campaign. I had my best mate with me. And we arrived in camp and I was just blown away by how organised and clever and thoughtful and beautiful it all was. And then on the Sunday, me and my friend were getting on the bus and I just said, no, I'm just going to stay. And I took my swag back off and that was the beginning of a long experience in those blockade camps.
That's like a scene from a movie, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. Maybe I make it sound like one now. I probably didn't feel like one at the time.
That kind of emotional moment of choosing a path to walk down. So you were living in these blockade camps. What was the day-to-day experience of that like? How did that look on the ground?
Sometimes there was five or six of us. Sometimes there was 50 or 60 of us. Most often between 5 and 10. We had tarpaulins strung up between trees and pretty well established camp kitchens, lots of locals bringing us fresh produce. Most of us didn't have cars. We were mostly between 18 and 25 years old. There was no mobile phones, you know, no one had any money. Mm-hmm. So we were very much reliant on the generosity and presence of community people who would come and visit us. Banners strung up in trees, lots of people visiting, and we'd walk them through the forest and talk to them about the issues. Those were the good times. The bad times were when those forests were actually in the process of being, first of all, bulldozed, all the understory flat, and then being logged, all the trees being cut down with chainsaws. Those times were much more challenging physically and emotionally, but we had an incredible culture. Not all the time. There was definitely challenges and conflicts. But largely, and the reason so many of us stuck around so long was because it was an incredible culture of collaboration and we took good care of each other.
How did you stop yourself from going, well, this is all completely stuffed, I'm going to go home to my bedroom and listen to, like, Alanis Morissette? That was that era, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. And I did. We all did that. But I didn't do it often. Probably every 4 or 5 months, I'd go home and I'd go back to my mum's place. She moved overseas about halfway through, but before she left, I'd go back to her place. And she remembers that I'd be really emotional, yeah. You know, and really exhausted. And I think that was a release that I needed. I'd come back and let it all out, but I was always going straight back. And it was because of the purpose that we had there, but it was also the friendships and the community that we'd built.
So how can we as a broader community make sure, and how can activists make sure that your mental health and your well-being is prioritised so you can keep doing this work?
I think it has to be deliberate. And you do see community organisations and, you know, larger environment organisations not prioritising that. And you see the impacts. And then it takes us years to rebuild the foundations of those organisations when people have fallen away and there's distress and trauma. This is hard work that we're doing, but we can make it a lot easier, well, a lot more manageable, sustainable, by deliberately thinking about what is it that people need while we're doing this work. And it's not rocket science. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there that we can draw on. And I've had to go to people for support with that. You know, I wasn't a natural staff manager at all. I'm a natural comrade, but having a setup where you've got employees and you need to give them job descriptions and performance reviews and all that stuff did not come naturally to me. So I had to go and seek support for that. And I've had incredible mentors. I couldn't have done what I've done without them.
Because you are now the convener of the WA Forest Alliance. How does this organisation centre the well-being of the people who are doing the work and on the ground pushing for change so that they can continue to do that work?
It's a big question. I think we do it in a couple of particular ways. We've got a very deliberate feminist collaborative leadership model, and that's come from some particular courses that I've done and that other women in our organisation have done. Women's Environmental Leadership Australia is an incredible course, so I recommend to everybody. And also we've got some senior women who've been around for a very long time in the nukes movement and the peace movement, in the forest movement, in the feminist movement, gay law reform, who've seen a lot and they know how to do this work well. And they actively mentor younger women in doing it well. So that, you know, far out, I'd say that and I just remember how lucky I am.
Yeah.
But also, you know, when I first started with Wafer in 2010, it didn't look like that. And it was hard. It was really hard. And I went seeking that out. And, yeah, thank God that I did, because I don't know where we'd be now if I'd put up with it.
I think that the women that you're speaking about would have had just the most amazing stories. Are you looking forward to being in your own crone phase and just being able to, like, give advice to the younger generations? Just have young people come up to you and be like, Jess, you're such an inspiration.
You know, I think if I said that to any of the women who mentor me, they'd be like, oh my God. I can talk about my experiences. I don't know that I've got, like, you know, packaged wisdoms ready for anybody. And maybe that's a function of being a natural campaigner. You know, you're always looking for the next gap and the next strategy and approach to working on it. We do need to spend more time reflecting. And I've been given a bit more of that time lately. But, yeah, mostly I'm just like, come on, let's go. We've got things to do.
So you'll still be moving forward as you're shouting advice back.
Over my shoulder.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
So when you think back on some of the things that, you know, you talk about always looking forward and looking for the gaps and thinking about strategy, when you do reflect and when you look back at the work that you've done, what are some of the proudest movements that you have?
Well, the two biggest, in 2001 when Jeff Gallop was elected, he was an incoming Labor Premier after a long, long time of a Liberal government with Richard Court at the helm. And we'd suffered so badly under that government, seen so much go badly wrong. And when Jeff Gallop was elected and said that he was now ending old growth logging, the really important part of that, because definitions are very problematic and you never know what's going to be passed in underneath those sorts of policy changes. But the important part was that 230,000 hectares, which is a massive area of the best that we had left at that point of the Karri and Tingle and Jarrah forests, were being protected permanently in national parks. That was mind-blowing.
We spoke a little bit when you first came in about spatial awareness. If we're talking, how many hectares?
So that was 230,000.
230,000 hectares. So how many houses is that? How many suburban blocks is that?
Well, a hectare is like 100 metres by 100 metres. So if you think of, can you imagine the whole of Kings Park?
Right.
All the way from the river, right up to Kings Park Road and all the way down to UWA. That huge, big, incredible Kings Park that we've got there, that's 400 hectares. So 2.5 of that is 1,000 hectares. And we protected 230,000 hectares. So it was a significant amount of forest that wasn't going to be logged anymore.
We all know that we would, as a community, as the Boolu community, we would do anything to protect Kings Park. You tried to chop Kings Park down, you'd have people out there going literally over my dead body, lie on the ground, and no one would cross it. Why is it that you think that people are okay with it happening down south?
Well, fortunately, I think West Australians aren't okay with it, and that's what's been our power. But in other parts of the world where the forests are further away or people are less connected to them, have less of a sense of their capacity to protect them as well, it's much, much harder for those communities. It's the same in the Belia wetlands, right? Just recently, 2017, the incredible outpouring of the community to protect that place from Roe 8. Same deal. People love their natural places. That's what it comes down to in the end, is protecting the places that you love. And if we all do that, then, and we believe that we can, you know, maintaining that hope, the world will be a much better place.
If we're good at it here and it's a struggle, what's it like in other places?
Yeah, well, Victoria's had a big breakthrough as well. So you asked me before what my biggest senses of achievement have been. The first one was that with the end of old growth logging, as it was defined. The second one was Mark McGowan, nearly 3 years ago now, announcing an end to native forest logging. And importantly, saying that 400,000 hectares of additional forest would now be protected. So, you know, huge, huge, nearly double the amount that we were able to protect in 2001. Then Victoria followed suit. So that's really exciting. But New South Wales and Tassie and Queensland are still just deep in the trenches and incredibly beautiful forests, you know. Lots of people know the particularly the Tassie forests, and they're still being just bowled over and the majority of the wood being used for wood chip. So it's still happening across this continent and certainly around the world.
So part of that achievement, part of that pride is seeing your work ripple out to other states and other places.
Well, I'm not sure it was our work that gave a tipping point to Victoria. I think the campaigns have been very state-based because it's a state legislation, state policy that will change it in the end. So we haven't probably collaborated as much as we could across the states, although there's, you know, enormous cross-pollination between individuals. But in Victoria, perhaps the state government there saw the change here and realised that it wasn't as politically risky as they might have feared, and that certainly assisted. But I certainly wouldn't be taking any credit away from the Victorian campaigners who absolutely slogged it to get to that point.
And yet at the same time, you do get hope from other campaigners and they get hope from you.
Yeah, definitely.
What legislation and regulations are still needed in WA?
Oh,
in your opinion.
Wow, where do you start? Well, we certainly need decent climate legislation. We haven't got that. They've avoided putting targets, legislated targets in place for 2030, and we're not going to even hope to get to net zero until 2050, which is just complete madness. So,
and also not going to work, right?
Well, it's based on so many different kinds of nonsense. And in the meantime, we're opening up new fossil fuel projects all over the state. And the impact that they're going to have in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions that they'll release out until 2070, Scarborough's hoping to go. Just blow your mind that we're still so backward. So certainly climate policy. We also need nature laws. We need laws that say these values are so obviously vital and equal or of more value than any economic social values that we could get from them. We have to protect them. We've got to protect them permanently and securely into the future. We're just not looking at it in that way. We're looking at it entirely through the lens of extractivism and human benefit.
When you say extractivism, you mean mining?
I mean the idea that there are natural resources that are there for our taking. So certainly mining, but also taking surface water for unsustainable projects of all kinds. It means logging just because you're only seeing the timber in the forest, you're not seeing the forest.
Mm. So basically we need to be, as a community and as a community of people with the civil responsibility to vote and contribute to the decision making, we need to be seeing not just the money that comes from the mines, but also the destruction that comes from that, and acting to agitate for change.
Yeah, I think we all are living in pretty challenging times. You know, the cost of living is just outrageous. That's not talked about enough. You know, the impact that has on individuals and their capacity to be politically engaged is real. So I think that needs to be a part of all of the solutions that we're contemplating here. We can't just expect people to be paying more attention to politics and working harder to make changes for longer term issues. We also need just to be finding ways to support individuals to be able to be more connected in their communities and then find that hope and support and capacity. But yes, ultimately, we do need as a society to be agitating for change because we're facing really serious, urgent crises.
We are agitating for change and we're working within the civic sphere to move legislation forward. You've made some decisions in your life, in your personal life, to also live out your values when it comes to the environment. What does that look like for you when it comes to your everyday life, not only working professionally for an organisation that is on the front lines every day, but also coming home and continuing that work?
So I remember in 2010, my kids were 3 and 1, and I was so struck by the significance of climate change. It was one of those sort of chapters in my life where I was like, whoa, this is big and real. What can I do? And I spent a lot of time very deliberately thinking about the best contribution that I could make given my personal circumstances. I was living in a little house on a bush block in North Walpole with 2 young kids who were my whole world. I didn't want to move to Perth. I didn't want to be taken too much away from my kids, but I wanted to do something really significant, substantial about climate change. So I decided, thinking about it very specifically and how many emissions from here and there and what are my skills, that I was going to focus on forests again. And then for the next 13 years up until now, that was my daily focus other than my kids and my home, my gardens. And when we had the announcement from McGowan that he was going to be ending native forest logging, and I looked at the carbon emissions that would now be not entering the atmosphere, and it's at a bare minimum between 40 and 60 million tonnes over the next 10 years, I felt so relieved. I felt so relieved I actually fell on the floor and cried that the sacrifice that my kids had made, even though I'd intended for that not to be the case, had been at least measurable and worth it in terms of a climate outcome that I'd committed myself to at the beginning of that chapter. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but I'm trying to balance all the time the different things that I love, the different values that I have, the different senses of purpose, knowing what the risks might be, knowing that choosing one path means that you're not choosing another one. And it's been just a huge exercise in perseverance and determination, and trying to find the time in every day to do things well. And getting to that outcome was, a vindication. It was like it was worthwhile. And now I just have to make sure that it bloody is, that that's not taken away from us and we're still in the process of securing that protection.
How do you think that people who can't live down south on an old farm and restore a forest in that space, how can they also make their own personal moves towards living in a way that is more respectful of the environment?
Yeah, and I think when we think about what's right in front of me that I can do right now, throwing that starfish back into the sea, even though you're not going to get to every single starfish, but that starfish got back in the sea and that's good. Picking up the rubbish on the beach while you're walking past it, those small contributions make a big difference. They make a big difference. But then the really significant stuff where we make massive change, big policy changes that are going to last a long time and really matter to a lot of different species and landscapes and people, they don't come from individuals. They come from groups of people. And, we're so often told the reasons for climate change, the reasons for whatever, are because of individuals and the fact that we're not doing X, Y, and Z. That's just rubbish. It's because of corporations and then it's because of lazy governments. So the only way we're going to turn that around is for communities to be rebuilt and come back together. So I think that's about finding something that you really love. It could be a little bit of bush down the road from you. It could be the creek down the road from you. It could be the beach nearby. And finding other people who are also connected to that place and then learning its story. What's going on for that place? Are there community groups around here who are taking care of it? And how might I contribute to that? And then it's just looking for things that really get you going, because you've got to have passion if you're going to be able to persevere through the hard things. So we need to find things we're passionate about, band together and then learn about it. And look for other people who can support us when things get hard rather than saying, I tried, but it got too hard, so, you know, I couldn't do it. We've all been through that. We've been through that 50,000 times. The thing that separates people who keep going from those who don't is people who are happy to say, I don't know what I'm doing. Can you give me a hand?
We spoke at the very beginning of this interview about growing up in South Africa and seeing the injustice that was in your face. And when you talked about how that relates to your environmental work, we looked back to 2,000 years ago. What I kind of see you doing is looking forward, doing that preventative work to make sure that the next generation has enough food, doesn't go to school hungry, can still go to school. When you think about that future and you think about your children, is that kind of where you get the tight feeling in your gut, the drive to keep going?
I'm someone who zooms the lens out and then zooms it back in again on a half-hourly basis. And I think I do that because I'm looking for a pathway that gives us the most hope. But when I find that I'm looking at something that's so outside of my capacity to comprehend or do anything about, there's that Joanna Macy quote about do not avert your gaze, do not look away. And it's about our capacity to be able to hold and cater for the grief that we feel when we look at that, when we look at that very big picture. I worry so much about my kids and their future. You know, we're only just seeing the beginnings now of the climate and biodiversity crises. On current trajectories, it's going to get a whole lot worse. So I'm trying to set our farm up so that they can feed themselves. It's an excellent permaculture property and, you know, they'll have water and power and food. And we're also replanting it so that it's doing the best that it can for the bigger picture, looking after the inlet and the wildlife biodiversity that are there. But also, you know, I think we just have to focus on what's in front of us and what we can do. My mum used to say to me, you know, don't worry about the whole picture. Just do today well. Just do every day well and let the big picture take care of itself. And that's where I end up resting. I don't want to look away from the grief. I think it's what gives us our capacity, actually, in the end, to be able to keep doing the work if we can hold it. But I also don't want to get consumed by it.
It's a process of acknowledging the potential future but acting in a way that preserves the present as well.
Yeah, I think that's right.
What projects are you working on right now that is in our present and that will have an impact on our future generations?
So the campaign that we're rolling out at the moment is called End Forest Mining Expansions. And that's focused on the Southwest Forest. There's been a huge proliferation of mining applications across the forests. And that's what I was touching on before, talking about the mistakes that we're making in trying to deal with climate change. There's so many applications from mining companies looking for lithium and nickel and copper and other minerals that are going to be needed for decarbonized economies under the forests, under the most incredibly beautiful old growth, biodiverse Jarrah forests. Anybody who walked through them would say, of course you shouldn't mine here. There's got to be some places in the world that are off limits to mining. Sure, we need to decarbonise, but not by sacrificing the last of the world's primary forests. So that's our focus at the moment. And the first step is to restrict and limit what's happening with Alcoa, which is a massive American mining company, strip mining across the Northern Jarrah Forest for bauxite. And we've got a once-in-a-generation opportunity right now to be able to limit what they're doing because they're facing all sorts of new approvals processes. So we're focusing very closely on that. Then there's another couple of really important things. There's prescribed burning, which is having a massive impact on the forest. So every year, the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions burns a target area of 200,000 hectares of the forests. Again, a massive area of forests. And they do that ostensibly to reduce wildfire risk. But we know that the way that they're doing it, the lack of sophistication, aerial bombing from the sky, 15,000 hectare blocks at a time, huge areas of forest, setting peat swamps on fire, granite systems, old growth tingle forests, because they're operating from the air instead of with sophistication and caution from the ground, we're just losing so much of those precious forests.
They're also operating from the perspective of a white person, right? We've been talking about prescribed burns for, I don't know, since I was in primary school, I remember talking about prescribed burns, right? This is the way that we've been told that the Noongar people did it. What moves are you making to ensure that the environmental protection is also in line with the First Nations values and First Nations practices?
Mm. It's so offensive to call it cultural, anything like the kind of burning that's been happening here for 65,000 years plus. It's nothing like it. There are some good cultural burning practices going on in Wurundjeri country, the Undulup mob over there, led by the Webs. Really, really smart, very good practice that's inspiring other people to see that there is another way to do it that's been here on this land for a very, very long time. There's real wisdom and science there that people are willing to share. And also out on Nudju country, east of Albany, there's some really excellent work being done there as well to demonstrate that. I just want to say 2 days ago, the Eads family were given back their land at Nowanup. And that was this project that's been run by Gondwana Link and Greening Australia and others for a very long time. Instead of just saying, let's buy up this old sheep station and replant it and connect it to the beautiful national parks on either side for biodiversity purposes, they went to the local elder and said, what do you want us to do? We want you to be at the front of this. And he's been leading that project since the start, and the results have just been incredible, not just for the land but for the people as well. And 2 days ago they were given the title back to their land, and that's the stuff, isn't it?
That's the stuff of bringing it full circle.
Exactly.
Jess, it's been so nice to meet you.
Really lovely to meet you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Congratulations on being inducted into the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And I look forward to speaking to you again sometime.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Thanks to Jess Beckling and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women and femmes who make her story on RTRFM happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Rachel Ang and Madeline Mitchell are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Her Story is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was produced on Wadjuk Noongar Boodja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respects to the Aboriginal elders of the land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au.